We're continuing now to talk with Tim Madden about the economics of the Canadian life. And we're going to look at the history of money and banking and the tax picture so as to give you an opportunity to really become aware of how the money that you use every day works. Canadian money is very nice to look at, but it's controlled by forces which the average person has no awareness of.
I think it's best to start from the beginning to show where we're at and then explain how we got here. The big problem, most people do not understand that there's a very solid connection between the banking system and the taxation system. Now, the way that the banking system works is that you are, in fact, funding your own loan. The bank does not loan its depositors' money. It does not loan what would otherwise be its own money. It first gets you to hypothecate whatever income you have coming in the amount of the loan to the so-called security document that is actually a funding instrument as well as a security instrument. So if you want a loan for $100,000 for a mortgage, you have to pledge $100,000 of your future income plus interest, usually doubling or tripling the amount that you are going to pay from the future. You bring it to the present, you hypothecate it or pledge it to that instrument, you then give that to the bank. The bank records in its own books that it has received from you the amount of the loan, and it then issues credit back to you, which costs it nothing because you have supplied the equitable substance of the loan. Now, what ought to be happening is if the government were to require banks to actually have the money that they purport to loan to borrowers, then the banks would have to go out and get the currency, and that would force the government to print the currency. It has nothing to do with inflation per se, because the same amount of purchasing power is created either way. In effect, the government is saying to the banks, you can use the borrower's equity and issue cost-free credit back to them based on that equity, and you can bypass the lawful currency system altogether. And as a result of that, as a direct consequence, the government prints virtually no money. Now, since 1980, for example, we're looking at 22 years. Over that period, the big five Canadian banks have increased their assets, meaning the total amount of money that they purportedly have and owe to people in the terms of depositors, nominal depositors anyways, by approximately $1 trillion. Okay, now the government over that same period has increased the total amount of money that they have printed in terms of currency, lawful, legal tender as it is, the tens, twenties, fifties, $100 bills, only by about $20 billion. So that's about 2%. So if the government were to enforce the Currency Act, which states that every financial transaction shall be executed in lawful money of Canada, and meant it, enforced it, then the government over that same 20-year period would have had to have printed a net $1 trillion, approximately, of currency, and that would have reduced the government's need to make up its revenue shortfall. They would have got the equitable credit for the increase in currency needs of the country that accrue to an expanding economy, and the government would have had to have printed $1 trillion over that period, and that would have displaced federal taxation. In fact, if you go back through the historical record, you see that this, what's called seigniorage or gain, is a well-recognized form of taxation and that governments were intended to rely upon, but they have essentially abandoned that right so as to allow banks to get their money for nothing is basically what it comes down to.
So let me ask a simple question from the point of view of a non-economist like myself. You're saying that there is on the books several trillion dollars rolling around the Canadian system, but the only 2% of that is covered by actual physical money. How can that actually work, and how does the taxation process keep that together?
Okay, from an economic standpoint, the first rule that they teach you when you take economics at university is that anything that functions as money is money. If you accept buttons, and if it becomes our medium of exchange, then whoever has the most buttons and the right to make buttons has a very decided advantage over the rest of us. Now, the thing that banks do is they trade, traffic, or otherwise deal in promises to pay money as if it were money, but since it serves as money, it is money. And that is the paradox that really messes with your mind and the reason why people just don't understand the fraud that is being perpetrated upon them. Now, if it were to work the same way on deposits and GICs and term deposits as it works on a loan arrangement, you would go into the bank and the bank would say to you, In return for your agreement to loan us, the bank, $100,000, we agree to give you a 100,000 GIC, or TD, or term deposit, whatever you want to call it. I think they call them CDs, certificates of deposits as well. The bank would then give you the certificate of deposit for $100,000, and you would turn around and give it back to them as the deposit itself. That is the banking scam in reverse. And 6 months later, when the term expired, you would simply go back to the bank and withdraw your $100,000. You would arrive at the transaction with nothing, and you would walk away with $100,000 or whatever the amount of the loan was, or the deposit in this case. The reason that brings the tax system into it is, again, let's say that this year there's going to be an expansion of the economy, that banks are dealing with unfunded liabilities in terms of lawful money of Canada that the government has the sole right to create and provide to the economy. So say the banks are going to increase their total loans this year by $100 billion, which is about right. They'll start with $1 trillion, and at the end of the year, they'll have $1.1 trillion, and so that they have created a new $100 billion of purchasing power in the economy. Now, if they wanted to do that under a fully funded system, they would have to go to the government and convince the government to spend that amount into circulation. And once they spend it by writing checks against the Bank of Canada, people would bring it to the chartered banks and the other financial institutions. They would make the deposits first, and then the banks could make the loans. But again, they would have to convince the government that they need to spend $100 billion this year, and they need to print the money to do it. The system that we have is the banks are saying, well, we're going to do this for free. We're going to directly monetize the asset we are receiving from the borrower, the alleged borrower, under the pretense of security, and you're going to allow us to bypass, to do it without having the reserves, the currency at the Bank of Canada, to back up our obligations to the depositors, who then bring the purchasing power back to the institutions and apparently deposit it, but in fact, there is no money there.
So what are the negative consequences of that situation? The fact that there is no money there, and that this is all generating more and more paper, not instruments of currency, but simply records of transactions. What are the negative consequences to the economy and to the individual, and how would that be changed or corrected if the government actually printed that money?
Well, if the government were to print the money, for example, the federal government of Canada has a total of $150 billion, more or less, in expenditures every year that they're spending on, you know, pension checks and health care, whatever. They write total checks for $150 billion. Now, $50 billion of that is interest payments that have built up. See, had they been doing this since 1975, say, or 1980, we'd use the same frame of reference, then they wouldn't have had to borrow the money every year to get the so-called deficit or budget shortfall. They could just print it. The immediate reaction, people have been conditioned to think, uh-oh, there's price inflation, the government's printing money. But the economy is expanding anyway, and it is solely a question of whether the banks are going to do it for free or whether the government is going to print the money and gain the seigniorage or gain from that, the equitable benefit. In terms of the larger effect on the economy, what I've studied over the years is the sort of exploitation of these alleged borrowers systemically by the large institutions. And they have a word for it. It's called being on the wheel. Once they've got you under their thumb, once you owe them $100,000 plus interest at 10%, at the end of the year, where does the 10% for interest come from if the government isn't printing any money? Well, the short answer is it doesn't exist and it cannot exist, and you have fallen into what they refer to as a debt trap. You are on the wheel and you can never get out of it. For example, why do you think when the rate of interest is 3%, bankruptcies are 3%? The rate of interest generally goes up to 10%, bankruptcies increase to 10%. 25%, 25%. There's a one-to-one relationship, and it is precisely because it's a game of musical chairs. And when the music stops at the end of the year, at interest rates are 10%, there's 10% more debt obligations at the end of the year than there was at the beginning of the year. There is no money to pay those, so 10% of the players have to drop out of the game.
That's very clear. That's a good example, because if there's not enough money in the supply, and yet the interest is building up over time, then the percentage of missing money is the percentage of players that are going to not have a seat and are going to have to drop out of the game. I know that in the United States, the whole system that affects us in a similar way started with the establishment of the Federal Reserve. And I also know that within a very short time, a few weeks or a few months, coincidentally in Canada, a very similar entity was created. Can you tell us a little bit about that historical moment and what the implications are and how it could be that just coincidentally in Canada at the same time as in the United States, a whole different system of national banking was established?
You're talking about 1913. And in 1913, you had the establishment of the Banking Act in Canada. And I think it was the Canadian Bankers Association was established at that time as well. Now, what you have to understand is that the Canadian Bankers Association Act is recognized from its inception as being legitimization of banks colluding against the public.
Prior to 1913, what was the situation?
If you go back to, say, the mid-1800s, banks had to have 50% of the money that they owed people in cash at the Bank of Canada, or the equivalent. There was no Bank of Canada at that time. But they had to have in their own vaults 50% reserve ratios. And what that meant is that if you signed a mortgage for, say, $100,000 back in the 1800s, the bank would have to go out and somehow find $50,000 of it to put in its own vault. It could only use half of the value you gave it to kick back to you as a loan. Now, over the years, that has been whittled down and whittled down and whittled down, and it went to 25%, I think, in 1913. It was at 20% for the longest time, and then 8%, and then 5%, and now it's zero. They don't have to have any actual reserve. You may notice that the banks are making it increasingly difficult to function with cash. You must have their cards, and in fact, debit cards, credit cards, whatever it is, they treat money as if it were dirty or something like that. And in fact, there's even rumors going around, they're planting them in the newspapers, that their currency is infected with various diseases. And it's just to erode public confidence. Now, I just finished analyzing a business in Kelowna, and they've got a throughput of about $1 million a year. But no matter what type of instrument this individual deposits into his business account, he is charged a fee. He's charged a fee if he deposits checks, 3% if he deposits Visa and MasterCard slips, and there is a cash deposit fee. I think it's 0.25%. So it costs you $2.50 to deposit $1,000 in cash. And a check is a 50-cent fee. There's nothing you can do in terms of a deposit that they do not charge you a fee for. And remember, what you're doing is you are making a gift of it to them. When you make a deposit, property interest in the money changes hands. So what they are in fact doing is you are giving them $1,000 in cash in exchange for an account credit that costs them nothing to provide, and they're charging you $250 as a fee for the privilege of giving them a gift.